This is Dr. David Black, founding director of the American Mindfulness Research Association. My guest today is Dr. Alan Weiss. Dr. Weiss is a professor of marketing in the USC Marshall School of Business and is founding teacher at the and director of Mindful USC, the university-wide initiative. He is senior teacher at Insight LA, where he has taught mindfulness classes for 14 plus years. And he completed the Dedicated Practitioners Program at Spirit Rock Meditation Center. I had the pleasure of giving several guest lectures to Dr. Weiss's class in business. That was an interesting approach to take, and we can probably learn more about that. But I want to welcome you, Dr. Weiss, for joining me here today.
All right. Thank you very much.
And you're also, you were a professional musician, right? And what's the little, we won't go too far in the detail there, but makes you super unique. What is that background like?
Well, it's interesting. I was a professional musician in my 20s. And, you just learn about music and all of that. And I kept on playing, even when I first became a professor at Stanford, before I came to USC.
And I know it's still in your heart, right? Because sometimes when we see each other, you have a guitar. Do I remember right? It's a guitar necklace.
Yeah, I still do.
Wearing it right now. That's awesome. So music in the heart, right? That's great. So you're the director of Mindful USC. It's a really interesting university-wide approach, perhaps, to wellness. Universities are integrating mindfulness courses, but this seems to be different. What makes Mindful USC perhaps different?
Well, I think the difference, when I started Mindful USC, I did it with the director, the dean of the Office of Religious Life. And one of the things that we did was we worked at the level of the provost of the whole university. So the first time that they ever announced it, it came out of the provost. So I think one of the things that's different about us is that we're at the level of the entire university.
And so how does that, what kind of effect does that have? It seems very important. It seems like there's buy-in. So what does having support at that level do when we're talking about a program that's going to have reach?
Well, I think the difference is that we teach in all of the five hospitals at USC, and we teach in every single school at USC, and we deal with faculty, staff, graduate students, and undergrads. And so it's very widespread. It's very interesting.
Yeah, those are a lot of contacts. Do you know, so I think you were mentioning to me earlier that there are 7 years that this has been ongoing, Mindful USC.
That's right. Yeah, I started at the end of 2014, and in fact, I think you were working with me to get data from that very first class. I remember very well.
Yeah, we were working together and finding some positive effects pre to post intervention.
Right.
And so with those years, with almost 7 years, how many people have you reached? Seems like there's so many schools, but like, do we know in terms of numbers?
We reach about 1,000 every year. And of course, when the pandemic started, we actually went almost to 2,000 people because we went online. And so for the first time, we've actually been also teaching alumni of USC, which is really interesting because when you teach the alumni, they're so thrilled. It's actually fun to do that because then when they realize that they connect with all the other people who are taking the class together. And so that's been fun.
Do the classes include the alumni and students together, or are there specific courses just for the alumni?
No, those are just for the alumni. All of the other classes, our general classes, have faculty, staff, and students in the same class. That's what's really interesting. It's very interesting for a professor And it's really interesting for especially an undergrad to see that they have the same emotions of anxiety as a faculty member, which is really good.
Yeah, and very probably important to see that we're all facing similar struggles. So that is a really interesting observation when you are able to witness as the teacher,
yes,
faculty that you may know,
yeah,
students that you may know or not, and the interaction between everyone, because in these courses, as part of the curriculum, people talk
right
about what they are experiencing.
Exactly.
And at the level of anxiety, at the level of what's coming to mind.
Yeah.
What have you seen certain cases, of course, you know, not talking about individuals, but circumstances de-identified where there is an amazing connect at the different levels? Because this seems really important at a university when faculty may struggle to connect with their students. Maybe this is one way to see how human a faculty member is. Have you observed something like this?
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, it's really interesting. I think the first time I was teaching in a residence hall, and there was a faculty member that was in the class. So you can imagine, you know, like maybe 15 freshmen and sophomores, and then this faculty member. And I can remember the faculty member almost breaking out in tears when we were talking about emotions. And, you know, I never saw anything like that when I taught at Inside LA.
Maybe they're new to the practice.
Yeah.
Newer to the practice.
Yeah.
And so, teacher, this is an amazing thing, in my opinion, that in one course, given that it's a university-wide program, the enrollment is voluntary. And so you have students who are looking for something that they either feel that they need or want to reduce some symptoms. I don't know. I wonder what that profile is, because you have so many unique and different places where people are coming from. One, it makes me think this is hard from a teacher's perspective. Like, does the teaching always flow given all of these different experiences? And then if it does flow, what are people looking for, you know, from these classes? Everyone's so different.
Right. Well, I always ask the students and everybody what they're looking for. And most of it's instrumental. You know, they just want to get over anxiety or something really like that. But some people are much more looking for a different way of just living their life. And so you get the same kind of overall changes, you know, from all of these different people. But, you know, in general, everybody's looking for the same thing that comes to mindfulness, you know. But it's been, it's very interesting because I've realized that I have to use different language with undergrads as compared to staff and faculty, you know, because, you know, undergrads don't really relate to stress as well as like a graduate student or a faculty member, you know, so they're really looking for something different, you know. And so part of the trick of teaching a wide variety is that you have to change your language depending on whether or not you're doing an undergraduate class or whether or not you're doing a graduate class or doing staff or faculty or whether or not you're in the hospitals. And then you have to use different language as well. So
is the language based on maturity level or is it based on vocation? Why is the language so important?
Well, like for example, if you're ever talking to undergrads, you know, I always think of the difference between like negative things. I mean, that's the way we normally think of, I'm going to lessen anxiety or whatever, to the middle, okay? But with undergrads, I emphasize more positive things on the positive side. So I might talk about more concentration or more resilience and those kinds of things. That connects more to those people. And then as compared to if you say, come to my class because I'm going to show you about how to get rid of your anxiety and all this negative stuff. That works well for staff and faculty, but it doesn't work really well for undergrads. Part of it is because some of them think that stress is good, you know, and so you have to be careful about how you just teach these people.
Stress is good, meaning they see it as an energizing force, like they need slight levels of stress to perform.
Yeah. Well, I usually go in and I say, stress is bad, it burns you up. And then I tell them that the way I work with it is I always say, passion is good, but stress is bad. I say, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure that you have more passion in your life. And they connect with that.
And it seems like we're getting into some of the language and content.
Yeah.
Of this curriculum. So did you develop a new curriculum for, let's say, the campus program that focuses on undergrads? Is there, like, how many sessions is it? What's the expectation?
Well, that's a really good question. I remember when I was thinking about doing this, I talked to Jack Kornfield, and I was talking with him because I was on the board of advisors for Inside LA, and so was he. And I remember talking about the fact that at a university, as compared to like a Buddhist mindfulness center like Inside LA, where you could have like an introduction to mindfulness for an hour and 45 minutes, you can't really do that very well on a university campus, especially like USC, which is downtown, okay? Because if you go from like 12 to 145, students can't do it because they might be able to, and staff can't do it, and faculty can't do it. In fact, no, just hardly anybody can do it. And so what I decided was to kind of flip the class idea that I had, that I was teaching it inside LA. Instead of six classes, I made it five classes. And the reason why I went to five was really given by the schedule of when we have fall break and spring break, okay? And so that was one way I changed it. And I said, I remember talking to Jack and saying, look, I'm going to go to five classes and I was going to try to, and then have 1 hour. So I was moving from six classes for an hour and 45 to five classes for only 1 hour. And I decided, okay, if I was going to do that, then I'm going to do it a different way. I'm going to spend more time really giving really clear instructions to people and try to get them to practice more at home. And that's one of the things that happens in some of these Buddhist centers is that sometimes people go and they only meditate when they go to class. And so I was trying to flip that and say, okay, we're going to meditate in class, but more importantly, that you meditate at home. And so I've spent a lot of time just experimenting how to make that work for people. So it's been a journey.
Well, that concept that it approaches what people talk about these days with a flipped classroom.
Right.
Basically asking students, do all this work and discovery of what's happening when you're present with yourself at home. And we'll do the same thing here, but then we can talk about it and, address any problems or concerns that come up. So it seems like a workable model, especially for a college student environment. And then so you started talking about class content, and it's five sessions. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll go through, if you could take just briefly, a description of each session for those who've never taken a course,
yeah,
who are
sure.
interested in a course. What might they engage in for these 5 weeks?
Well, it's pretty simple. I mean, we start off with just, mindfulness of the breath. And then the second class is mindfulness of the body. And the third class is mindfulness of emotions. And the fourth class is mindfulness of thinking. And then in the fifth class, we do mindfulness of mind states and loving kindness. And so, but as I say, I think for me, different is that I spend time, like in the first week, not only teaching the breath, but I talk about habits and I'm using the theory of habits so that, because I realize that mindfulness and meditation is a habit that people have to develop. And so that's why I say that I spend a little bit more time on preparing people for starting to do a daily practice. And so, That's the general way that we kind of teach the mindful, what we call, I call the mindfulness lab. That was the other thing I did at the university is I branded the mindfulness class, because at Inside LA, we just call it the introduction of mindfulness or the basics of it. And I thought, well, we're in a university, so I just call it the mindfulness lab. And that's our 5-week class.
How many participants are usually in class?
Oh, usually, we usually get about 50 people who sign up for the class. But because it's free, that doesn't mean everybody shows up. So, but you can get anywhere from 30 to 50 or so who are going to show up on the first day. And this is the same for all of our classes.
And those are the in-person classes that you get those same numbers, or is this a jump because of the online?
Well, when we went online, because when the pandemic started, because the demand was so large, we went to 100 people, I couldn't even put up enough classes because they would just sell out so fast. But 100 is not an ideal. I mean, an ideal size is 20 people. But the reason why we would do it like 50 or 40 on the ground at USC is that, you know, since they're free classes, if you have it like at 50, you'll probably get somewhere around 25 or 30 at the most or so. And so I kind of like work with, kind of the system as it is.
And given that it's a free course, and there are so many held a year, how does this model work? I mean, I'm assuming it's something that most universities can dedicate resources to. How have you worked that out generally to make this something that can last over the years? It's been successful 7 years. Right. And so there's got to be support coming from somewhere.
Well, we don't really have support. I mean, somebody gave us some money at the beginning, but we've been always on a shoestring. But, you know, I'm a marketing professor. So, you know, that's what I do in the Marshall School. So I use my marketing skills here. I've really tried to brand and get it into throughout the university. So the whole concept is mindful at USC. We have the website mindful.usc.edu. And I have the email address mindful@usc.edu. Okay. And so, you know, I worked with undergrads to start like an Instagram, stream. And, you know, but I was really pushing the name Mindful, you know, Mindful USC. And so we have a really good brand name, you know, and that's been part of the struggle, because there's always a kind of a pressure to kind of like start putting in other classes that are not really mindfulness classes. And so I've had to, you know, really work for that. But most universities, I think the trick with most universities is that, you know, it's kind of like to get it off the ground, you need to have some place on the university who's willing to communicate out to people about what you're doing. And what I've learned is, for example, at USC, we have the Gateway, which is an email that goes out to all the staff at USC. And so so I take advantage of that as a vehicle to get our name out a lot. And then you work with maybe the graduate council so that they tell all the graduate students, or you work with the undergrads, okay? You can't really do this for the faculty, but you can go to the academic senate. And but you know, if you're willing to get out there and really kind of like get people coming to your classes, you can take advantage of the word of mouth, because people will tell other people. And so that's the way I've done it at least at USC.
That's important. So for others who want to do something like this, have a good marketing program, have a larger administrative delivery of communications for the program. And it seems like we need some coverage, right? There are a lot of teachers in this part, as part of Mindful USC, and they're teaching different courses, not just the 5-week course. I know there are other outlets. Right. Maybe we'll talk about those, and then the importance of getting some support, and maybe the universities that are interested could have some coverage either for teachers or for one coordinator to manage teachers.
Right. So, see, like what I did, I started by teaching all the classes. And then, and so then what I did was I started working with Inside LA to kind of get other teachers there, other teachers who could help teach some of these classes. But on top of that, what I really wanted to do was I started thinking that there's a lot of people who didn't want to take just a regular mindfulness class, and that they would, and then what would happen is that I needed what I call the gateway class, okay? And so I started thinking, okay, so what are people doing at the university? They're writing. Okay, a lot, everybody writes. So what I did was I got somebody at Inside LA who taught mindful writing. And that class really took off. And then I realized that there was other people who, for example, did creativity, like in the dance school or whatever. So I had a class on mindful creativity. A lot of people, you know, staff and faculty and graduate students have our parents. So I put together with somebody to do a mindful parenting class. So I call these gateway classes because my idea was that somebody who might not be interested really in mindfulness yet, but would be really interested in doing better writing, would take a class. And then what would happen would be that they would maybe sit there and say, okay, now that I've done this, I really want to know more about mindfulness. And so that they would maybe then take a mindfulness class. So I've kind of built this out. I've tried mindful photography because, again, I thought, you know, gosh, you know, there's students and, you know, they don't want to take a mindfulness class, but maybe they want to learn how to take pictures better or something like that on their phones. And so we've tried various things that really help kind of like give people different doorways into taking like a mindfulness lab class.
That is a very wise approach, it seems to me, because individuals may not realize that their interest merges
right
with some state of mindful attention or skill development.
Right.
So how does... Something that came to mind as you're saying this is, so someone's interested, say, in dance, and you have you mentioned mindfulness writing and mindfulness in the arts. It seems like we could say it attached to any human behavior, and especially at the university when we're talking about performance-related behaviors, doing well or doing better at something you want to do regardless of mindfulness.
Right.
How do you said you can create a gateway or a doorway of making those things come together. Some people may not realize, how do you make something like that come together without making it seem artificial or like trying too hard to say, yeah, you want to take good pictures, but let's do mindfulness and that'll just work out. Right. How do you join them in a way that seems like just flowing for students? And has it worked? And there's circumstances where it doesn't.
Well, again, I don't teach these classes, but I have really good teachers who are really, you know, and when I say they're trained at Inside LA, that means that they have a Buddhist background. Okay. So they understand they don't want people pushing really hard and doing all of this, you know. But, you know, the reality is we work in a university, right? And so I don't, even when I teach my mindfulness class, I don't shy away. I don't try to tell people, oh, look, you know, just be okay with everything, et cetera, because it's very confusing for people. It really is. And so I try to be really clear that, you know, that when we're learning mindfulness, I use analogies. I always use like practice, like being at Dodger Stadium and hitting a ball over and over and over again. Doesn't mean that you in practice, you don't go home and start beating up everything with your bat. You know, what happens is that when somebody throws you a 98-mile fastball, you know what to do with it because you've been practicing. And so I try to let people know, because you see, if you don't tell people that you don't have to be mindful 24/7, they're going to think they're a loser once they walk out of the class and they slip. And so, you know, this is something that I've really learned from doing this for a long time, which is that if you don't talk specifically to people about, you know, what mindfulness is and when they can use it and when they don't, you know, you're not going to get very far with this. You can't go into a hospital, for example, and tell, you know, doctors like, oh yeah, a gunshot wound just came in the emergency room. Oh, isn't that interesting? It's just like this, you know, etc. You have to show them mindfulness and then help them understand how that fits into their daily life. That happens much more in a university than it ever happened, for example, at Insight LA, because, you know, Insight LA is a Buddhist mindfulness center and people go there. And so they're there, but they're completely detached from their workplace. Whereas a center like Mindful USC is like right in the middle of a work environment. And so that's been interesting because you get blindsided by it if you don't if you're not aware of it, because you'll sit there and just be talking and people will immediately raise their hand and say, well, how do I use this? I have a paper that's due tomorrow. What am I supposed to do with this? You know, just say, oh, look, it's just like this. I don't have to work at it. Just relax. You know, that's what I'm saying. You have to couch it right for people to understand it.
This seems to be a specific challenge for maybe an academic setting, a university mm-hmm. delivering mindfulness. It's you are surrounded by folks taking your classes that are highly performance oriented. Right. And I assume they face the same things with sports performance and mindfulness. So you have some important lessons there. What might we have learned about mindfulness programming for high performers and how best to deliver this? You made a really good point about you have to distinguish between those times in which mindfulness may be useful right. and those times when you just have to sit down and not be lazy or right. do other motivational tactics. Yeah. Are there other, with that and others, have you found this to be relevant for high performers?
Yes, I have. I mean, a really good example of this is a woman who's at Children's Hospital who's taken my class. I remember, I'll never forget her coming up to me after I showed her how to process difficult emotions using, you know, classic mindfulness ways of processing difficult emotions. And she said, you know, I go to one bed and I see have a difficult conversation, and then I go to another bed and I have another difficult conversation. She says, then I go back to my office and I do exactly what I taught her to do. And she said, I'm able to process these difficult emotions that I have. And she said, the reason I'm doing this is because I don't want to bring them into the next bedroom that I go into. And I think that's a really good example of what I'm talking about. This person's in the real world. They have to do things. They have to have all these things. But what they're learning is that they have these that they can take some of the techniques that I've shown them and the overall view that I've shown them and use them when they need to. And I think that's really important. I always tell them that when I go on retreat, you know, I see monks that are on retreat with me. This is especially at Forest Refuge in Barre, Massachusetts. And everybody thinks, oh, these people just doing this 24/7. But then when you go into like the room where everybody's eating and you're sitting there because you're like the studious little mindfulness and you're doing bowing to your food and doing all that, you look over at the monks and they're just shoving food in their mouth. They're hungry, you know. And so they're not, you know, so there's a time and place, you know, for everything. And that's one of the things I'm trying to give people. And I think by doing that, you're giving them a sense that, yeah, I can do this. I can do this.
You're taking us to the work in kind of the clinical world, maybe. And so that may differ from what you observe with students, especially on that spectrum. You were mentioning students may want to boost performance, do better on exam, whereas clinicians, physicians, surgeons, hospital staff, administrators you're working with are coming to this program saying, I'm burnt out.
Right.
And I want to like manage emotions before I get home. So What are lessons to be learned about in a university-wide program working with, say, the faculty and the staffing and people who are part of a medical team? What are we learning there in the delivery of our programs?
Well, I think when you get into the hospitals, I mean, but this can happen also in other parts of the university. A lot of people think that mindfulness is this kind of, you know, spiritual, you know, fluffy thing, et cetera. And, you know, the way that a lot of teachers try to handle that, and you see this mostly when you get into the medical school, okay, especially because I do a lot of work where I teach the introductory people coming into medicine, but I've also done it with surgeons and anesthesiologists. A lot of people, you know, the way that they handle that is they talk about chemicals and cortisol and all, they'll talk about brain chemistry and all these things that happen with mindfulness. I don't do that. You know, I do it in a much more phenomenological sort of a way. And so one of the things I do is I explain to people that as human beings, and this includes every single person on this earth, has reactions, natural reactions that they don't control. And I'll show people that by having them just close their eyes and focus on the breath, and their attention will wander away. Okay? They don't have any control over those things. Those are just natural first reactions. The Buddha called that the first dart. But they do have reactions. They do have agency, and they do have responsibility for how they react to that. Okay? And so oftentimes what I'll do is I'll read a poem to them by Rumi, the guest house. And I just read the very beginning of it. It says, "This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival. You know, a joy, a depression, some sort of a meanness comes as an unexpected visitor." So I'll tell people, I'll say, these things that are arising are just unexpected visitors. And I say, now you know what how mindfulness works, right? Mindfulness works by helping you stop reacting to these uncontrollable natural reactions we have as human beings. Once I get that across, even people who think this is fluffy stuff will get it. They'll say, ah, now I understand what we're doing when we're meditating. I'm basically showing you, just pay attention to the stuff that arises and don't react to it. And then they can understand it. And I raise this because I think a lot of times what we do to make mindfulness kind of like seem like it's kind of, you know, it's really important is to couch it in medical terms. And, you know, the problem with that is that people can't see neurons firing together, wiring together. They can't see things like their cortisol. They can't see any of this stuff. But what they can see is their own personal reactivity. And so I find that by just grounding it in something that people can actually see, helps with these, I just call them skeptics. And if I go into Verdugo Hills Hospital, and I'm sitting there presenting to like 100 people who are all in the leadership position, there's a lot of them who are just thinking, this is pretty nonsensical that this guy is going to be talking about. And I want them walking away saying, this is not nonsensical, this is real. And so,
can we explore that, Al? I think this is an unresolved issue. In a room, let's imagine this is the case. Like you said, there's a room of 100 people. I don't know. Help me put a number on this. How many people are the skeptics? Are there 20? Are there 90?
That's a really good question. I really don't know. I once did a presentation for the LA Medical Examiner. Okay, so imagine sitting in a room with 50 people from the coroner's office, okay? And these people are like leaning back and saying, this is all nonsense, etc. And then I knew I was in a room with like, you know, 80% skeptics. When I go to a presentation, like I'm doing a presentation on Sunday in the Price School as part of like a leadership program that they do in the Price School, when I walk in, there'll probably be a small number of people, but maybe 10%, 15% or so, who are skeptics. There's a lot of people who are like on the fence, and a couple of people are really excited about it. And my job is to take all the skeptics and turn them into people who are more open, etc. And so it's kind of a dance of how you do that, you know. But I do know that if people don't understand why they're meditating, you know, that's what I'm saying. They can understand mindfulness, but they don't understand, like, why am I meditating? You know, it's kind of like saying I need to get them the stuff that's under the hood so that they really understand I'm meditating to really just notice these uncontrollable natural reactions and stop reacting to them. People get that. They understand it, and I find it's much more clear than other ways that I've tried to explain it.
So you were getting across that you have to get buy-in.
Yeah.
From, you know, as many people as possible, especially perhaps from the skeptics who might need something like mindfulness the most, because they may be skeptical about other things that may also help them. You are conveying one way in which you do that with your description, with your under the hood language approach. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because some people may be trying to get across to various groups who are in administrative levels, they are, you know, people who are at risk of burnout, say a group of surgeons, and, you know, we really want them to not be so burned out. Can you go into that a little bit more, like the language to convey to them and cases that maybe you won over? Well, what are the aha moments for a person trying to communicate that?
No, I mean, it really depends on the context, et cetera, right? You know, if I'm dealing with people who are burned out, sometimes I have to, it takes me a little bit of time, but, you know, again, I'm teaching mindfulness, so I need to explain really early on, not only what mindfulness is, but how it works. Because, again, if people don't understand, like, how it works or, like, why it's working, you know, it's kind of like any skill, right? You know, a lot of people say, well, okay, just practice and the burnout will go away. Just keep practicing. Don't look for anything specific. Don't grasp out of anything. Just practice. The burnout will go away. What you're doing is relying on people's hope, their faith, and their faith. And the problem with that is, I just want to digress for a business, is that for a lot of skills, and mindfulness is a skill just like any other skill that you might have, it's not a skill that goes in a linear manner. The more you practice, the better you get. Okay, there's other skills that don't work that way. Okay, like when I was a professional musician, for example, I sat down to learn how to play guitar, not play guitar, but how to do a finger pick. And I practice every single day. Some days were good, some days were bad, they were horrible, etc. But I just kept on practicing. And then one day I got a lot better. So in the language of mathematics, that's called like a quantum leap jump. Okay. And that's what happens with mindfulness. You've got to keep people on long enough and then they'll have a quantum leap jump. To get them to that point, the experience of meditating just seems like it's going nowhere, right? And you have to have faith that it's going to go somewhere. So what I do is I have to explain, this goes back to what I was saying, I have to explain, like, why it's working on you. Like, what is going on under the hood, as it will, okay? If I can keep doing that and explain what's going on under the hood, I can keep people, like, on that path, you know, to starting to get to the point where they can start to resolve this burnout, okay? Now, I don't only do that, right? I talk about it, you know, when we're not meditating, I talk about other things. But when I'm sending them off to meditate, I really want them to understand, like, I'm not just meditating, I'm doing something very specific here.
And the under the hood target mechanism that you were referring to, I think earlier, was non-reactivity.
Yeah.
So recognition.
Yeah.
That reactivity is a driving force for suffering.
And that's right.
Is that the connecting piece? that links up to all the emotional class.
That's exactly right.
And all the other classes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not just saying this. This is what the Buddha said. You know, so there's nothing that I say isn't consistent with what I've read in the Pali Canon, that the way the Buddha actually explained it. In fact, the fact that it's a skill, I always say that if you go in the Pali Canon and you look at how the Buddha talked about mindfulness, he always used skilled craftsmen to talk about it. And the reason is that it's a skill. It's a skill of the mind. But once you get that, once you understand it's a skill of the mind, then you can relate that to other skills that people do. And so it doesn't seem so wild and foo-foo and crazy and all of that when I can say, just like, you know, you would be an airline pilot and you would have to learn the skill of how to fly an airplane. What you're doing is learning the skill of mindfulness. And I think that's, I find that that's really helpful for people who are more skeptical of it, because since I'm using metaphors and similes and ways of kind of connecting the practice to other things that they already know. They know how to, for example, they know how to, like, they learn football or something like that, or they learn baseball, or they learn how to paint, or they learn how to play music or something like that. So they already have that experience. And so if I can just port that experience of that skill development over to mindfulness as skill development, it doesn't seem so strange and weird and just purely spiritual. Now, I want to be clear. I'd like these people to become spiritual. It's just that that's not my goal at Mindful USC. My goal is to just get people into the practice.
And the definition of spiritual that you're thinking of, Alan, how is that?
Oh, the spiritual part?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, usually what happens, and this happened at Inside LA, people would come up at the end of an introductory class and they would say to me, they'd say, there's something more to this, isn't it? There's something more to all of this. And I would say, yeah, you should take a Buddhist class. And that's how they ended up taking Buddhist classes. The trouble is, at a university, we're purely secular. So I can't say to people, oh, go take a Buddhist class. What I do is, they will tell me that they feel that there's something more to what's going on. And I'll say that there is more. And then I've started teaching a mindfulness lab 2, which is a level 2 class, where I'll actually bring in a lot more of that, in a kind of secular way, but allowing them to see a little bit about some of the what they're thinking of as a more spiritual approach to, just meditating, etc.
Yeah, and just to put it into secular, perhaps Western terms, you're talking about pro-social qualities, compassion, right action that is not hurtful to self or others, for those who are wondering what we're meaning perhaps by spirituality, that would be perhaps part of it.
Yeah, that would be part of it, right? I mean, it wouldn't be too crazy to talk about right speech, for example, to tell people, don't do harm, and especially bringing up sila and other things that are, which is the reason that why we talk about loving kindness at the end of the class. We're starting to open up to some of these other issues. But.
Which even some of that may have interesting biological circuits for and reasons that humans have evolved to even have this capacity, right? So if we're training into be more compassionate and we have a knack for being pro-social, it may just be reinforcing something that naturally brings us a sense of well-being. So there could be biological pieces, even to talk about there before someone has to even go into the spiritual realm.
Right.
Realizing that once, and you can show this empirically too, you ask someone to go out and start doing pro-social acts and you measure their psychological states of well-being, or some people are suffering from depressive affect, younger adults, and you ask them, here are some things that you can do to be pro-social, and you start to see improvements, it can be similar in that way. Right,
exactly. So there's a lot of directions that you can go at that point.
And at Mindful USC, to bring us back there, is there any other group? Have we covered them all? Is it so we have our faculty, staff, administrators, students, the hospitals that we're getting coverage for? Am I missing anything? Are we trying to do community level organization?
Well, unfortunately, this is something that happens when you're at a university. They usually don't want you to do anything other than just for the people at the university. You would need outside money, for example, to say, okay, I want to start doing it for the community around my university. And so we've never been able to do that. Even at Children's Hospital, we've been able to do it with the doctors and the nurses, but not with the parents that come with their children. And so that's a limitation of being at a university, And so there's nothing you can do about
it. Do you see a demand for what we're maybe calling university affiliates, like you're saying, the patient base that we serve at one of our institutes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. There would be, I think there would be a huge demand. And we could certainly cover it. It's just that, again, it's like competing demands for all of these things. So, that's just the nature of working, in the university. But going back to like the skeptics, what I've learned is that some of the administrators are some of the skeptics that I've had to explain. I will say one thing, that when I talk to people who are higher up in the university, I don't talk about Mindful USC as being just a nice thing. I talk about it as being central to the university mission. I'm serious about this. And the reason is that I just did this a couple of weeks ago in an executive provost meeting that I was in. I did a little meditation, and when I was all through, I basically said, what we do at Mindful USC is central to the mission of this university. And this is key, because a lot of times mindfulness just gets thrown into this general bucket of well-being. And in well-being sits yoga and just about, laughing and Reiki and all these other kinds of practices that are just well-being. And to be a force at a university, you have to hook into the mission of the university. This is key to me. And so you've got to have a language that talks about how this is not just a nice thing, but this is central to the mission of the university. And I think if you do that, you have much more luck at being able to take a program and actually get it at the level of the whole university than just like at the level of, say, the hospital or the student health center or something like that, which is where it is at a lot of universities. And it's thrown there because people will say, oh, it's just well-being. And, well-being is like having psychiatrists and we have some mindfulness things going over there and things like that. I really try hard to not get into that trap. And it's really easy for people to put you in that bucket unless you state it clearly of what your mission is.
It matches well to what I'm reading now is the central mission of the University of Southern California. It says the development of human beings and society as a whole through the cultivation and enrichment of the human mind and spirit.
What they say. Well, let me just be clear. Universities will always say all this stuff, but fundamentally they want the students to do well, and they want the faculty to publish papers, and they want everybody to do all this stuff. So I don't hook it into the mission like that, David. I hook in the mission of saying, look at what would happen at your university if people, for example, weren't bothered by difficult emotions and difficult thinking. What would be the nature of your university, if people had more loving kindness and were more open to other people. And I say that is central to the mission. I can't sit down, and I personalize it. I say I can't sit down to write a paper, a research paper, if I'm bothered by negative emotions and negative thinking. See, again, it's like when people, because every university is going to say, oh, we want to do the whole person. You know, it's like when our kids were young and they were going to high school, every high school said, you know, it's the whole kids. You know, this is just language that people use. My experience is that you do much better if you get beyond that and get right to the real mission of the university, which is making money and getting a lot of research done and getting a lot of students graduated. And that's what I'm saying is, I'm saying Mindful USC can help people get graduated. We can help them, faculty, get more research done. And, you know, that's what I'm saying is I pitch it at that level because it's really easy, as I said, for it to just thrown into this well-being pot. And once you're there, you know, you're just there with everything else that's called well-being, because it's such a reified word now that it has no meaning anymore.
Yeah, your point is well taken. I still like this definite. I see your point about, you know, having multiple reasons for having a mission and perhaps parts of the mission unstated. But if we look at that definition, to me, it was actually speaking on the behalf of something like Mindful USC, because it says the cultivation of the human mind, right, and the enrichment of it. But okay, so from what I can see in working with students, I think I've had well over 1,000 different students in all my courses, PhD, master's level, bachelor's level, and we're really focusing on content delivery and assisting in critical thinking cultivation, right? So it's like, can you use a logical thinking system? Even in some classes, can you recognize in some psychology courses, and I'll teach this sometimes in behavioral economics, recognizing arousal systems, their effect on decision making, and I'm sure your school of business does similar right. things. But what Mindful USC is doing, and I won't use the generalized term wellness, but part of this mission element, the cultivation of the human mind, is students, we don't typically have classes that recognize their relationship to their own mind, right?
So right.
Isn't that part of the education? Because we can just send them out, and it's like the way you've approached consciousness and the way your mind thinks, you take that with you. Mm-hmm. We add on learning content. And so now you have access to that, and then move you forward and you go to the next stage, whether it be graduate school or what else. But I don't know. Have you seen anything at the university outside of Mindful USC? And maybe this is an essential argument, is that it's the piece, Mindful USC, it's the piece where it's the cultivation of the relationship with your mind. And that definitely is education. That's part of cultivating our students. But I don't see that anywhere. Do you? What have you seen there?
No, I haven't seen that. I mean, usually people are studying other people's minds and things like that. As I'm saying, mindfulness is just 180 degrees turned right around on yourself. And so, but it's just the way education typically is. It does it from an objective third party perspective.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Students are studying the content of other people's mind, which is fine. It's how we share social information through a culture that's focused on the transmission of higher order information in college years. So that's great. But it's a huge point that we don't get students typically to focus on their relationship to their own mind. It's
that's
just
right.
assumed they know how to do this, or it's right. assumed that whatever suffering that they have from a perhaps kind of poorer relationship with their mind and not recognizing why they're suffering from anxiety
That's
is
right.
part of the education, right? And if we don't do it now, the question is when will they have a chance to do it? I mean, there are community-based programs, there are psychotherapies later in life that can aid with this type of thing. But just to get back to this point, I like to still argue it's central to the mission of the university, regardless of how any one university administratively interprets this. Right. And I'd still like to believe that most of the faculty, including yourself, myself, still do believe in this element. And so when we teach our students, we're not thinking administratively, we're thinking, how do I make my students the best of critical thinkers, the best of knowing thyself, and the best of sharing whatever information we can pass down in our culture? So I think the faculty level, we have an underlying philosophy, but yeah, the university may have a whole bunch of priorities that we don't know. So, but I'm glad we have, you know, this program. Is there anything with going back to our students? Are there aha moments? Because that's all sometimes the greatest. I'm putting on my teacher educator hat right now. And, you know, you can go long swaths of time. Nothing really happens. You're seeing students progress and how they progress. But then there are moments that remind us like, oh yeah, there is something big happening underneath. And maybe it's not always stated. And right. Are there moments that you can recall like that you're like, oh, wow, so something's really taking effect here?
Well, I mean, I've had so many students, you know, I had students leave me cards that say, thank me for turning me on to liberation, you know. Those are the real moments, you know, because students in particular, you know, they come, that's why I'm always saying, if you don't grab them in the first class, since it's free, they won't show up anymore. And that's the reason why it's really imperative to connect with people with undergrads, because they're the most likely to just kind of like say, okay, I'll just get a juice. I'll go to a juice bar and that'll solve all my problems, you know. But, you know, every once in a while I'll get students, and you could just see that they just, all of a sudden, they just kind of get it. It's like, and I can't even tell you what they've got, because it's just, but I know implicitly what they've got is I can live my life in a different way. And they see it. And, you know, I don't stay connected with them. Sometimes they show up in another class of mine, and then they'll come up and we'll talk about it. But it's very rewarding because, you know, as I said, I say to my colleagues in the business school, I've never, ever had a student after my, like, digital marketing class come up to me and say, oh, my God, you've changed my life. But it happens all the time with Mindful USC. Right, people will come up and they'll say, you know, you've really changed the way that I think about myself. And, you know, and that's the rewarding part of it. The politics are not rewarding, but the actual teaching of it is very rewarding.
So those interested in running this at the university level, just be prepared for the common administrative challenges.
That's the reality of it, yeah. Is that, you know, to me, when you start something and it was just me, and all I did was I just did everything, it was really fun and really different. But as you start getting up, you know, becoming bigger at the university and there's more people involved, you know, you start dealing with the people who have to pay the teachers. I mean, just give like one example of it. You know, it turns out the university wants every teacher to be have insurance. And in order to have insurance, instead of like them just getting their own insurance, what they do is they have them go through a service that USC uses, Kelly Services. And then all of a sudden it becomes like calls with Kelly Services or the finance department about why some teacher hasn't been paid. You have to have a stomach for stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, these are important practical issues in running a program like that. So that's really important.
Yeah.
I think one part we have to address that people commonly either don't address, or it's just something that's not as interesting to talk about, but I think is important, is any adverse events that I don't know if you want to talk about it from the perspective of students saying there's an adverse event because of the program, like I felt uncomfortable, or you recognize early on that an adverse event was possible, because it was definitely beyond the purview of this program to treat like a mental health disorder. Have you observed those types of things? So we know how to better protect our students and faculty.
No, that's a really good question. I mean, it's one of the reasons, again, like why I had well-trained teachers, because well-trained teachers will be able to see if, for example, you start seeing something that you need to refer them to the student health center, and all our teachers know about that, you know. But I will say that ever since I've been teaching, and I've been teaching now for 15 years, I've never had a problem with any student. Now, I've had people, of course, who have had difficult emotions, you know, and so, but, you know, people think that if they just accept their difficult, and this is one thing I've learned, is that a lot of times what you're dealing with is that people think that they're going to crumble if they accept their difficult emotions. They really do. And so when they see a difficult emotion come up, then, and they start accepting that, for some people, that will start to traumatize them, okay? And so you have to be really conscious of, like, only letting it go so far. But for other people, they start to accept their difficult emotions, and they see that they don't last very long. And then they come up and they go, you've just changed my life. I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that it's a really thin line. And that's why I say you have to have a trained teacher who can tell somebody, for example, don't focus on the breath, focus, open your eyes and just focus on your hands, on your legs, to meditate, because you can see that somebody is just not steady, or, and you just start learning this the more you teach.
Were there any events where you thought referral to, say, mental health counseling services was necessary? Do we also see that, because it's important to be on guard for seeing something significant and wanting a person to get the correct care at a university?
Right. I personally have not. I'm not sure if the other teachers have, you know. But again, you know, like when I started Mindful USC, I would never forget the Dean of Religious Life had me come in and talk to somebody who was suicidal. So, you know, that's the other side of it, you know. He thought that by allowing me to talk to the person who he thought was suicidal, I could help this person, you know, calm down, which I did. But I cannot say that that I've taught, you know, where, especially in, now when it's online, it's much more difficult because you can't see everybody. But when we're on ground and we're teaching, I'm very aware of what's happening with everybody in the room, because we're usually sitting in a circle, and so I can see that everybody, and I can see whether or not they're having an adverse reaction to meditation. They usually will talk to me about it afterwards.
Yeah, and I think when we say the word adverse, it could mean a lot of things. And yeah, you know, whenever someone is uptaking a new skill, there's also always discomfort, right? So anxiety when you're paying attention to your mind and realizing you are feeling anxious. And
right.
So I those events, the ones that I was referring to are like, if there are instances when someone clearly needs additional help, it's probably good practice that we all rely on counseling services, and not students not thinking that this is their psychotherapy course.
Absolutely. But I will say that a lot of those people don't sign up for a mindfulness class. But I could easily imagine that somebody might show up, like in one of our mindful writing classes, because they might just show up, you know, because they think they're going to be doing writing. But again, Amy Spies, who teaches that, is very well trained. And so I have a lot of faith in the teachers.
Very good. Very good. And looking forward, okay, so we've been talking about mindfulness in the university, a wide scale dissemination project that you've been on for 7 years. And looking forward, you know, the idea of a mindfulness, of a disseminated large scale mindfulness program at a university that is accessible to so many different groups, the faculty, the physicians, the related hospitals, the student body, and alumni. looking forward, is this the right model? And is there other things you've thought about, like to build this, to keep it going, to make it stronger, heading towards the decade anniversary of Mindful USC?
Well, I will tell you that one thing I've been working on and I've talked to people about is bridging mindfulness with diversity and equity. And part of the reason for that is that I've been reading a fair amount about a lot of the diversity and equity programs and how they're not really helping at all. Forbes had a big article about how there's been a big, you know, that what we really need are people to look for inward. Part of this came about because I had one of the diversity and equity people in my class a couple of years ago, and she came up to me at the end of the class. I didn't know who she was. And she said, what you teach is what we need in diversity and equity. So I've been talking with some of the diversity and equity people who do, and I've done some classes with in the business school with our head of diversity and equity. And it's really interesting because, you know, I can talk about, say, mindfulness of emotions and get people to pretty much calm down about their emotional life. And then this woman who was Sharoni Little would come up and she would talk about kind of like how we view other people. And it was just a nice bridge between what the diversity and equity people talk about and what mindfulness talks about. I see this as kind of like one of the future ways that Mindful USC can grow in terms of being even more relevant into a university by making that bridge.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Weiss. Let's conclude for today.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it was a wonderful conversation. Our listeners can find our recordings at goamra.org, where you can support us by becoming a member or a subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.